Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Saturday, April 11th, and we have today's reading of the Boston Herald being read to you by Ken. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. Hello and welcome. From the police blotter, three people, two cats, saved from fire next to Bridgewater PD. A fire broke out next to the Bridgewater police station early Friday morning, and some quick thinking by both civilians and first responders saved the lives of three people and two cats. This situation could have turned out much differently if not for the quick actions of several people, said Bridgewater Police Chief Christopher Del Monte. Jamie Marie Sheridan and Eduardo Alvaranga stopped after seeing the fire, called 911, and tried to alert the residents, and Officer Hutchins immediately stepped in to make sure everyone got out safely. Their actions made a real difference. Sheridan and Alvaranga were driving by at around 1:23 p.m. when they say flames from a house at 7 Crescent Street, which is next door to the police station. Sheridan told a dispatcher she had tried knocking on the door but got no response. That's where police officer Mark Stephen Hutchins came in. According to a statement from the police, his own knocks were able to wake one of the residents who answered the door, and then the other two residents were awakened as smoke began to fill the home. Once safely outside, the police statement says, the residents said that two cats were still inside. Hutchins was able to find them and take them outside to safety. But the flames grew larger and multiple gas containers blew up inside the garage, causing it to collapse and frustrate firefighting efforts. Our firefighters arrived to find heavy fire in the garage and quickly went to work to keep it from spreading throughout the entire home, said Fire Chief John Schultz. Thanks to the quick alert from the public, the quick actions by police, and the coordinated response from our crews and mutual aid partners, everyone was able to get out safely and no one was hurt. Robbed at Bear Spray Point. Boston police say that multiple people were sprayed with bear spray, a much stronger version of pepper spray, as they were robbed while dropping items at a Dorchester address. Police say it all went down a little after 2 p.m. Wednesday when an unstated number of victims were dropping some items off at a home located at 7 Topliff Street. There, three others descended on them with bear spray, firearms, and even a rock, the latter two weapons used to strike the victims in the head. Responding police had a feeling the suspects were inside the building and quickly homed in on a single apartment, according to a BPD statement. They secured the apartment, got a search warrant, and arrested three suspects. Sebastian Ficou, 23, of Dorchester, is charged with assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. Natalia Moore, 18, of Dorchester, is charged with three counts of A and B with a dangerous weapon and one count of armed robbery. And Delroy Beckford, 33, of Boston, had three active warrants for his arrest for drug offenses, motor vehicle law violations, and assault and battery charges. In an incident summary, the Boston Police Department responded to 308 incidents in the 24-hour period ending at 10 a.m. Friday, according to the department's incident log. Those included five aggravated assaults, one residential burglary, one theft from a vehicle, two stolen vehicles, and 18 instances of miscellaneous larceny. Okay, moving right along. Rollins rips political rivals, claims double standard. Disgraced former U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins insinuated that her past transgressions have been judged more harshly than her male counterparts, like Suffolk D.A. Kevin Hayden, after drawing backlash for joining the D.A.'s race. Funny, men can have a state ethics violation, pay a $5,000 fine for using their official position as Suffolk D.A., to secure the substantially valuable and unwarranted privilege of the DA's office to their own personal political advantage to win their 2022 election and have integrity, Rollins wrote Friday on X. In April 2024, Hayden agreed to pay a $5,000 civil penalty for violating conflict of interest law by allowing his office to issue an official press statement aimed at discrediting his primary opponent, former city councilor Ricardo Arroyo, days before the election. Rollins' post references the violation issued by the State Ethics Commission. The post came 2 days after Rollins pulled papers with the Secretary of State's office to run for Suffolk DA, a position she held for 3 years before being appointed as U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts by President Biden. Hayden, when asked for comment about Rollins' move to join the race by a Herald reporter on Thursday, said he had none. His office did not respond to a request for comment about Rollins' post about him on Friday. Rollins' decision to run for her old Suffolk DA post came after weeks of speculation and has drawn criticism given her past transgressions. She reacted to the criticism on Friday by not only ripping into Hayden, but also former Suffolk DA Dan Connolly and ex-Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray. Rollins succeeded Connolly as DA. And Dan Connolly, talking about integrity and honesty, is like Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray lecturing us on safe driving, Rollins wrote on X. Of the 500-plus years of wrongful convictions and counting undone during my tenure as DA, each approved by the court, Dan ignored police corruption and prosecutorial misconduct. Connolly likely set Rollins off through an interview he gave to the Boston Globe on Thursday about her following her decision to join the DA's race. He described her as unfit to hold an office that demands truthfulness, fairness, and public trust. Through her actions, Rachel Rollins has shown that she lacks the two most fundamental qualifications for serving as district attorney, honesty and integrity, Connolly told the Globe. Rollins resigned as U.S. attorney in May 2023 amid an ethics scandal revealed during a federal investigation. She had been sworn into the role just a year prior after Congress narrowly confirmed Biden's appointment, with then-Vice President Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote. Her progressive policies had given some federal lawmakers pause in Congress, including the controversial Do Not Prosecute list she implemented during her time as Suffolk DA for low-level crimes like shoplifting. She resigned as U.S. attorney after being scorched in two federal reports that found she abused her position by improperly disclosing sensitive Department of Justice information to the media about a possible investigation into the Suffolk DA, Hayden, while he was running for election, to try to influence the race in favor of her preferred candidate, Arroyo. After a nasty race, Arroyo lost the 2022 Democratic primary to Hayden, who then ran unopposed in that year's general election. The two federal reports stated that Rollins faced further discipline from the feds if she did not promptly quit. Rollins was later issued a public reprimand for the ethics breach cited in the two federal reports by the State Board of Bar Overseers, which oversees her bar license, last October. The board voted to accept the reprimand Rollins agreed to last June for leaking the sensitive DOJ information to the media, but three members of the board dissented, preferring to reject the penalty as too lenient. Disciplinary proceedings by the board are generally triggered by allegations of misconduct against an attorney, which could lead to disbarment, resignation, or suspension by the court, public reprimand by the board, or admonition by the Bar Council, according to Supreme Judicial Court Rule 401 for bar discipline. Rollins is the second candidate to pull papers to challenge Hayden for DA this year. Linda Champion, an attorney who ran for Suffolk DA in 2018 and finished fifth in a race that Rollins eventually won, has also pulled papers to run. Hayden drew challenges after his decision to charge a Boston police officer with manslaughter last month in connection with a fatal police-involved shooting that led to the death of a carjacking suspect. He's drawn criticism from the city's largest police union of the rare move to charge the officer, which has led political insiders to speculate that he may be suddenly vulnerable in the race. The federal investigation against Rollins that led to her resignation as U.S. attorney was sparked by her appearance at a Democratic National Committee fundraiser headlined by then-First Lady Jill Biden in potential violation of the Hatch Act after it was first reported by the Herald. The Herald has since reported that Rollins tore through her taxpayer-funded credit cards during her time as Suffolk DA, spending lavishly on travel accommodations, posh hotels, and fancy restaurants. Rollins, who works now as an executive director for a program at Roxbury Community College, positioned her move to try to reclaim public office as a comeback story. "I always tell my daughter and nieces that circumstances don't define you," Rollins wrote Wednesday on X. "No one gets to tell your story but you. Every moment in life, whether victory or defeat, is temporary. What endures is who you become in the face of that hardship and what you do moving forward. Dare greatly." Judge tosses DOJ lawsuit seeking mass voter rolls. A federal judge has dismissed a DOJ lawsuit seeking Bay State voter rolls in what the President Trump administration says is an effort to root out voter fraud. U.S. District Court Judge Leo Sorokin, nominated by former President Barack Obama in 2013 and confirmed by the U.S. Senate in 2014, tossed out the suit on the basis that it offered no factual justification, a mandatory prerequisite. The Department of Justice filed the suit against Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin in December under then U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi. This case is one of more than two dozen brought by the United States against state election officials seeking production of statewide voter registration list, Sorokin wrote in his ruling. The United States complaint, The United States complaint fails for the simple reason that the Attorney General's demand did not comply with Title III of the Civil Rights Act of 1960, the statute on which it purports to rely. For this reason, and as elaborated below, this case is dismissed. Sorokin wrote that the DOJ did not provide a statement explaining why the Attorney General demands the records be produced, adding that the reason cannot be based on speculation. Simply, the statute requires a statement of why the Attorney General demands production of the requested records, and as conveyed by the statute's use of the definitive article, the statement must be the factual basis, not just a conceivable or possible basis, Sorokin said. It's the latest in a series of rulings in federal court in which judges have ruled against the Trump administration's efforts to obtain voter information from states. Similar rulings have been made recently in Oregon, California, Michigan, and Georgia. Appeals are pending in several of these cases across the country. Galvin and State Attorney General Andrea Campbell are celebrating the ruling, calling the Trump administration's lawsuit cruel and harmful. "I am very pleased that the court has recognized that the Department of Justice's demand for unfettered access to personal voter data was completely without any stated basis or purpose. Private voter information should never be the subject of a fishing expedition," said Galvin in a joint press release with Campbell. "Today's ruling is a decisive win for Massachusetts voters and the rule of law. The privacy of our voters is not up for negotiation, and I will continue to defend the integrity and security of our elections from the Trump administration's cruel and harmful agenda, Campbell added. The Trump administration launched a federal probe into state voter information in May 2025, sending letters to 40 states demanding they provide full electronic voter files. Those include information related to registered voters identified as ineligible to vote due to being illegal immigrants or having a felony conviction, the state's voter registration and list maintenance procedures, how election officials process applications to vote by mail, and how they verify registered voters are not ineligible to vote. The federal government had specifically requested voters' full names, dates of birth, residential addresses, and state driver's license numbers, or the final four digits of Social Security numbers. The administration says it's requesting the information to root out voter fraud and ensure election integrity. The DOJ sent a letter to Galvin on July 22nd requesting Massachusetts voter information, giving the office 14 days to respond. Galvin's office replied by requesting 60 days to issue a response. The DOJ sent Galvin another letter on August 14th, again demanding the information. After months of no response, the Secretary of State's office informed the DOJ it would not be providing the requested voter information on December 4th. The DOJ filed its lawsuit against Galvin and his office on December 17th. The law is clear. States need to give us this information so we can do our duty to protect American citizens from vote dilution, said Assistant Attorney General Harmeet Dhillon in a press release announcement announcing the lawsuit. Today's filings show that regardless of which party is in charge of a particular state, the Department of Justice will firmly stand on the side of election integrity and transparency. SJC allows AG's suit against Meta to continue. Massachusetts AG Andrea Campbell is claiming victory after the state's highest court ruled that social media giant Meta is not immune to litigation that argues Instagram has addictive features that exploit children. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court has determined that Campbell's lawsuit against Meta, which owns Instagram, can move forward, denying the parent company's appeal to dismiss the case. Campbell sued Meta in 2023 over alleged unfair business practices that prompt children to use Instagram compulsively. The AG also argues that the parent company is misleading the public about Instagram safety and that the platform is a public nuisance. Victory. Meta tried to get our lawsuit against them for fueling the youth mental health crisis thrown out, the AG stated in a Blue Sky post on Friday. But unfortunately for them, the courts just ruled that the case will continue. As your AG and as a mom, she added, I'll always fight to demand accountability from the big tech and safer spaces online. The SJC's determination brings the case back to Suffolk Superior Court, where Judge Peter Krupp disagreed with Meta that the parent company is entitled to immunity under federal law that prevents platforms from liability for content that users post. Meta requested the SJC overrule the lower court's determination. The High Court, though, found that the Federal Communications Decency Act of 1996 does not bar the parent company from complaints over whether its business practices violate state consumer protection laws. Meta has made changes to protect children on its platforms, including Facebook and WhatsApp, providing more tools to parents and introducing teen accounts, according to a company spokesperson. The spokesperson called Friday's ruling from the SJC procedural and said that the decision doesn't address the merits of the case. We are confident the evidence will show our longstanding commitment to supporting young people, the spokesperson said in a statement. The AG's office has found that over 300,000 13 to 17-year-olds use Instagram daily across Massachusetts. The Commonwealth alleges that in pursuit of maximizing advertising profits, Meta has designed Instagram to induce compulsive use among young users to the detriment of their health and well-being, part of Campbell's complaint states. Judge Dahlia Wendlandt wrote to the SJC opinion published Friday that Campbell's lawsuit against the company does not seek to impose liability on Meta for information provided by third parties. Instead, the claims allege harm stemming from Meta's own conduct, either by designing a social media platform that capitalizes on the developmental vulnerabilities of children, by affirmatively misleading consumers about the safety of the Instagram platform, the justice wrote. Thus, at least at this preliminary stage of the litigation, Meta has not shown it is entitled to the protection provided by Section 230. This comes as the Massachusetts House has passed a bill that restricts social media use for children, banning student cell phone use during the school day, and adding language aimed at addressing addictive feeds and protecting certain vulnerable groups. The bill, which the House approved this week, moves on to the state Senate. This is a matter of protecting our children with regard to public health, Education Commissioner Chair Representative Ken Gordon said of the social media provisions. It's a matter of standing up to big tech, just as we stood up to big tobacco in the past. And in Joe Battenfeld's column, meet the most powerful politician in Massachusetts. A once obscure Democratic state senator from sleepy Ashland, unelected by most voters, has emerged the most powerful public official in Massachusetts, topping even Governor Maura Healey in clout and impact. Senate Majority Leader Karen Spilka tells the governor, the House Speaker, and even the mayor of Boston what to do, and right now stands as the biggest obstacle to transparency in the legislature. Most voters don't know her and certainly never voted for her, yet Spilka, who represents the 2nd Middlesex Norfolk District, controls the agenda in the state and how taxpayer money is spent. Spilka is reelected without opposition in 2024, getting just 68,762 votes, a tiny fraction of the population of Massachusetts. But she has managed to stay relatively scandal-free, unlike several of her Senate president predecessors who moved on. While Spilka does not appear to have statewide ambitions, the position of Senate president has traditionally been a launching pad to lucrative lobbying careers. And there's really no reason for Spilka to quit or run for governor because she holds more power than any lobbyist or the current occupant of the corner office, Maura Healey. When House lawmakers this week announced a breakthrough $4 million funding initiative to tackle Boston's mass and cast drug issue, Spilka, who has feuded with Wu, was conspicuously absent, casting doubt on whether the funding will ever be approved. Spilka and her fellow Democratic state senators stopped Wu's commercial tax hike plan last year, angering the mayor and prompting her to challenge two senators who publicly blocked it. But Wu, notably, did not put up a challenger to Spilka. The Ashland senator is also engaged in a very nasty public dispute with Auditor Diana DiSoglio over the voter-approved audit of the legislature. DiSoglio has compared Spilka to a monarch, saying she rules and reigns over Massachusetts just like a queen. Spilka, with a straight face, retorted that the legislature's actions are, of course, democratic, a ridiculous assertion considering the way she runs the Senate. She also denied not wanting the legislature to face a voter-approved audit with DiSoglio, in which DiSoglio is leading. "We have really worked hard to increase transparency," she said. Spilka has often been in conflict with House Speaker Ron Mariano, and essentially nothing happens in the legislature without Spilka's approval. If Mariano were a Simpsons character, it would be Homer. While staying away from scandal, Spilka is, after all, a creature of the Massachusetts Democratic hackerama, and has as bad a case of Trump derangement syndrome as any other liberal Democrat. She raised eyebrows earlier this year by comparing President Donald Trump's illegal immigration crackdown to the Holocaust. I've been open and honest that this moment, what is happening across our country, reminds me of what my family experienced in Poland in the 1930s, leading up to World War II, she said at the annual Immigrant Day celebration at the State House. When people targeted my family with violence because they were Jewish, like this government today, even targeting now because of people's looks, their accents, the way they speak, and that is unacceptable. The State House turns classroom on Student Government Day. First was Student Government Day at the Massachusetts State. Friday was Student Government Day at the Massachusetts State House. Students from across the state participated in the event that was enacted by the state legislature in 1947. The event is intended to provide an immersive experience in the state legislative process by allowing students to engage with representatives and empowering them to voice their own informed views on current legislation, according to event documentation. Juniors and seniors were elected at their respective by their classmates to represent their schools and then enacted roles to learn about government processes. In Peter Lucas's opinion column, End of an Era, Trump could split with NATO amid Europe's lack of support in Iran war. If President Donald Trump is serious about pulling out of NATO, he would begin first by pulling U.S. troops out of Europe, particularly Germany. He could use an exit line from Groucho Marx, who used to say, "I wouldn't want to be in any club that would have me as a member." The problem for Europe is that without the U.S., there would be no NATO. The U.S. founded NATO after World War II to protect Europe from Russia, then the Soviet Union, and has been supporting it ever since. Back then, NATO was made up of only 12 countries: the U.S., Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, and the United Kingdom. Now it has 32 members, none of which seem too anxious to help Trump out in Iran or in opening the Hormuz Strait. The next thing you know, Trump will be opting out of the United Nations, an organization founded and funded by the U.S. that also began after World War II with 50 nation members. It now has 193 members. Without U.S. financial support, NATO would be like the UN, a club where members talk a lot but accomplish little. And as far as Russia goes, Europe does not have much to worry about, or so it would appear. Russia dictator Vladimir Putin cannot even defeat Ukraine, let alone take on Poland. Even the days when Germany used to invade France are long gone. Which led to the line one day when I asked a German in Munich how long it would take to drive to Paris. He looked at me with a straight face and said, "By car or by Panzer?" As of now, the U.S. has some 40,000 troops stationed in Germany to protect it from Russia. Germany has no troops to protect the U.S. from Iran. When Trump asked for NATO help with Iran, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said, "Germany is not part of this war, and we do not want to become part of it." German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said, "This is not our war." To which Trump replied, "Well, Ukraine is not our war, but we helped." The anti-Trump, anti-U.S. sentiment was echoed by British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and French President Emmanuel Macron, another stand-up guy who said, "We are not party to this conflict." This is what President Franklin D. Roosevelt could have said had he canceled the June 6, 1944 Normandy invasion that led to the defeat of Nazi Germany and set France free, something the French army, which folded, failed to do. The key problem is that while the U.S. has poured billions of dollars into Europe, from the Marshall Plan to NATO, the recipients have used that money for their generous cradle to grave welfare programs rather than on their military obligations. And all the while, they have been critical of the U.S., which is the hand that fed them. Trump called the arrangement a one-way street, especially as they rebuffed his request for help with Iran. The perceptive Ari Fischner, President George W. Bush's spokesman, put it best when he said, "When this is over, the western part of NATO will never be the same. Spain, England, France, and Italy have sold us out, as they too often have a history of doing. Eastern European nations are the heart of NATO. They spend money on defense, know how to fight, and love the U.S. He had in mind countries like Poland and Hungary, whose people fought off oppressive Soviet communism to become open, free-market, democratic countries, while Germany, France, and the U.K. are being strangled by socialism and unchecked Muslim immigration. And all the while, some 80 years now, the U.S. has shouldered the cost and burden of providing for their defense, while they have wallowed in socialism. Those days are over." Veteran political reporter Peter Lucas can be reached at peterlucas@bostonherald.com. U.S. and Iran prepare for high-level talks. Islamabad. With the ceasefire in Iran still shaky, U.S. President J.D. Vance headed Friday to Pakistan for high-level talks with Iranian officials as Israel and Hezbollah militants traded fire and Tehran maintained its stranglehold on the Strait of Hormuz. Many issues could derail the truce and the negotiations aimed at making a broader deal to stop the fighting permanently. Iran's semi-official Tasnim news agency, close to the Parliamentary Revolutionary Guard, claimed that the talks set for Saturday would not happen unless Israel stopped its attacks in Lebanon. And U.S. President Donald Trump said on his social media platform that Iran has no leverage except to restrict shipping in the strait, through which 20% of the world's traded oil once passed. Kuwait, meanwhile, said it was targeted by 7 drone attacks since Thursday that it blamed on Iran and its militia allies in the region. Though the Guard denied launching any assault, it has carried out attacks across the Mideast in the past that it did not claim. Preparations for the talks between Iran and the U.S. appear to be moving forward, with Vance boarding Air Force 2 for the long flight to Islamabad. Elsewhere, negotiations between Israel and Lebanon were expected to begin Tuesday in the U.S. capital, Lebanese President Joseph Aoun's office said Friday. Beirut is keen to hold direct talks to end the war between Israel and Hezbollah, but under a ceasefire similar to the one with Iran. Before his departure, Vance said he believed that negotiations with Iran will be positive. But he added, "If they're going to try to play us, then they're going to find that the negotiating team is not that receptive." In Islamabad, security forces locked down key parts of the Pakistani capital, erecting barricades along routes from the airport to the city. Hours later, the Iranian delegation, led by Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Kalibaf, arrived in Islamabad, Iranian state TV reported. The delegation included security personnel, military, economic, and legal teams. The report said negotiations will begin only if the other side accepts Iran's preconditions. Earlier in the day, Khalibaf posted on social media that 2 points he said had been mutually agreed on: a ceasefire in Lebanon and the release of blocked Iranian assets have yet to be implemented. These two matters must be fulfilled before negotiations begin, he wrote. Israel and Lebanon will have direct negotiations. Israel's insistence that the ceasefire in Iran does not include a pause in its fighting with Hezbollah has threatened to sink the deal. The militant group joined the war in support of its backer, Iran. The day the truce was announced, Israel pounded Beirut with airstrikes, killing more than 300 people, according to the Lebanese health ministry. It was the deadliest day in the country since the war began February 28th. Trump said Thursday that he had asked Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to dial back the strikes. Then, on Friday, Israeli warplanes struck near a state security office in the southern town of Nabatheh, killing 13 officers, according to the Lebanese president's office. Israeli forces said they also hit about 10 rocket launchers in Lebanon that had fired toward northern Israel. A day earlier, Netanyahu said he authorized the negotiations with Lebanon with the aim of disarming Hezbollah militants and establishing relations between the neighbors, which have technically been at war since Israel was established in 1948. Aoun's office confirmed that the two sides were set to negotiate after Lebanon and Israel's ambassadors to the U.S. held a call with Washington's ambassador to Lebanon to discuss terms. The U.S. State Department will mediate. In a first statement since Israel announced direct negotiations with Lebanon, Hezbollah chief Naim Qassem urged Lebanese officials to stop offering free concessions, but he did not take a clear stance on the talks. 2 days after Israel's barrage, people sifted through the wreckage of their homes, trying to salvage furniture and personal mementos. Some expressed gratitude that they did not lose loved ones. There is no substitute for family, said Wasim Tabila, 35. Everything else can be replaced. Strait of Hormuz remains a sticking point. Iran's closure of the Strait of Hormuz has sent oil prices skyrocketing, driven down stocks, and roiled the world economy. Tehran's control over the waterway has proved its biggest strategic advantage in the war. The spot price of Brent crude, the international standard, was around $97 a barrel Friday, up more than 30% since the war started. Before the conflict, over 100 ships passed through the strait each day, many carrying oil to Asia. With the ceasefire in place, only 12 have been recorded passing through. Trump said Iran has little clout in the negotiations. The Iranians don't seem to realize they have no cards other than a short-term extortion of the world by using international waterways, Trump posted Friday. The only reason they are alive today is to negotiate. Questions linger about missile and nuclear programs. Questions also remain over the fate of Iran's missile and nuclear programs, which the U.S. and Israel sought to eliminate in going to war. The U.S. insists Iran must never be able to build nuclear weapons and wants to remove Tehran's stockpile of highly enriched uranium, which could be used to make them. Iran insists its program is peaceful. Trump has said that the U.S. would work with Iran to remove the uranium through, though Tehran has not confirmed that. More than 3,000 people have been killed in Iran, a top Iranian officer told the state-run Iranian newspaper. Iran's government has not provided any definitive death toll from the war. And in the Middle East, Zelensky. Ukrainians shot down Shahed drones during Iran war. Kiev, Ukraine. Ukrainian military personnel have shot down Iranian-designed Shahed drones in multiple Middle Eastern countries during the Iran war, President Volodymyr Zelensky said, describing the operations as part of a broader effort to help partners counter the same weapons used by Russia in Ukraine. Zelensky made his first public acknowledgement of the operations Wednesday in remarks to reporters that were embargoed until Friday. He said Ukrainian forces took part in active operations abroad using domestically produced interceptor drones proven in countering Iranian-designed Shahed drones used by Russia in Ukraine. This was not about training missions or exercises, but about support in building a modern air defense system that can actually work, Zelensky said. Ukraine took part in the defensive operations before the tentative ceasefire in the Middle East was reached among Iran, the United States, and Israel this week. Zelensky did not identify the countries involved, but said Ukrainian personnel operated across several nations, helping strengthen their air defense systems. He previously said that 228 Ukrainian experts were deployed to the region. In exchange, Ukraine is receiving weapons to protect its energy infrastructure, along with oil, diesel, and, in some cases, financial arrangements, he said. The Ukrainian leader said the arrangements would bolster Ukraine's energy stability and described the partnerships as something that would be marketed as Kiev seeks to formalize and expand its defense export role. We are helping strengthen their security in exchange for contributions to our country's resilience, he said. This is far more than simply receiving money. Ukraine will face more pressure. The disclosure comes amid concerns that conflict in the Middle East could divert Western military support from Ukraine, particularly air defense supplies. But Zelensky said that partners were continuing to supply missiles for Patriot systems, adding that a new batch had arrived in recent days, and that Ukraine was working with all partners to ensure its air defense remained in place. He warned that the coming spring and summer would be difficult for Ukraine, with growing political and battlefield pressure as the United States turns to domestic politics and elections. Zelensky said he had urged U.S. envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner to visit Kiev and proposed a trilateral format with Moscow. It remains unclear whether they will come or if talks will instead take place in a third country. U.S.-led talks have made no progress on key issues as Washington's attention shifts to the Middle East conflict, while Russia and Ukrainian forces remain locked in fighting along the roughly 1,250-kilometer front line. Separately, Zelensky said he expects Western allies to restore full sanctions on Russian oil, warning that any easing could allow Moscow to sustain its war effort and offload key energy assets. Russia has been profiting from a surge in global energy prices brought on by damage to oil and gas infrastructure in the Gulf and Iran's blocking of the Strait of Hormuz, a vital sea route for global supplies. Ukraine has stepped up strikes on Russian energy sites to cut oil revenues as prices rose and U.S. sanctions eased. Zelensky said partners had urged Kiev to scale back attacks during Iran's disruption of the Strait of Hormuz, but he argued Russian oil has a limited impact on global markets. I won't say who asked us to do this, but partners did ask. It's a fact. They asked at different levels, from political to military leadership. Putin declares Easter truce and Ukraine ready to reciprocate. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine is ready to mirror any ceasefire steps after Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a temporary Easter truce. We proposed a ceasefire during the Easter holidays this year and will act accordingly, Zelensky said Friday on X, People need an Easter free from threats and real movement towards peace. And Russia has a chance now not to return to strikes after Easter as well. Putin on Thursday declared a 32-hour ceasefire over the Orthodox Easter weekend, ordering Russian forces to halt hostilities from 4 p.m. Saturday until the end of Sunday. Previous ceasefire attempts have had little impact, with both sides accusing each other of violations. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described Putin's move as a humanitarian gesture, but said Moscow remains focused on a comprehensive settlement based on its long-standing demands, a key sticking point that has prevented the two sides from reaching an agreement. Peskov also confirmed that Putin's envoy, Kirill Dmitriev, is in the United States for meetings focused on economic issues. He noted that Dmitriev is conducting the meetings within the framework of a group on economic issues that he has led, adding that he is not involved in the talks on the war in Ukraine, and his trip doesn't mean the resumption of the talks. Artemis II astronauts return from moon trip. Houston. Artemis II's astronauts returned from the moon with a dramatic splashdown in the Pacific on Friday to close out humanity's first lunar voyage in more than a half century. It was a triumphant homecoming for the crew of four, whose record-breaking lunar flyby revealed not only swaths of the moon's far side, never seen before by human eyes, but a total solar eclipse. Commander Reed Wiseman, pilot Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Canada's Jeremy Hansen hit the atmosphere traveling Mach 33, or 33 times the speed of sound, a blistering blur not seen since NASA's Apollo moonshots of the 1960s and 70s. Their Orion capsule, dubbed Integrity, made the plunge on automatic pilot. The tension in mission control mounted as the capsule became engulfed in red-hot plasma during peak heating and entered a planned communications blackout. All eyes were on the capsule's life-protecting heat shield that had to withstand thousands of degrees during reentry. On the spacecraft's only other test flight in 2022, with no one on board, the shield's charred exterior came back looking as pockmarked as the moon. Like so many others, lead flight director Jeff Radigan anticipated feeling some of that irrational fear that is human nature, especially during the six-minute blackout that preceded the opening of the parachutes. The recovery ship, USS John P. Murtha, awaited the crew's arrival off the San Diego coast, along with a squadron of military planes and helicopters. The astronauts' families huddled in Mission Control's viewing room, where cheers erupted when the capsule entered from its communications blackout and again at splashdown. The last time NASA and the Defense Department teamed up for a lunar cruise reentry was Apollo 17 in 1972. Artemis II was projected to come screaming back at 36,170 feet per second, or 24,661 miles per hour, just shy of the record before slowing to a 19-mile-per-hour splashdown. A perfect bullseye splashdown, reported Mission Control's Rob Navis. Artemis II's record flyby and views of the moon. Launched from Florida on April 1st, the astronauts racked up one win after another as they deftly navigated NASA's long-awaited lunar comeback, the first major step in establishing a sustainable moon base. Artemis II didn't land on the moon or even orbit it, but it broke Apollo 13's distance record and marked the farthest that humans have ever journeyed from Earth. when the crew reached 252,756 miles. Then, in the mission's most heart-tugging scene, the teary astronauts asked permission to name a pair of craters after their moonship and Weissman's late wife, Carol. During Monday's record-breaking flyby, they documented scenes of the moon's far side never seen before by the human eye, along with a total solar eclipse. The eclipse, in particular, just blew us all away, Glover said. Their sense of wonder and love awed everyone, as did their breathtaking pictures of the moon and Earth. The Artemis II crew channeled Apollo 8's first lunar explorers with EarthSet, showing our blue marble sitting behind the gray moon. It was reminiscent of Apollo 8's famous Earthrise shot from the 1968. It just makes you want to continue to go back, Radigan said on the eve of splashdown. It's the first of many trips, and we just need to continue on because there's so much more to learn about the moon. Their moonshot drew global attention as well as star power, earning props from President Donald Trump, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, Britain's King Charles III, Ryan Gosling, star of the latest space flick Project Hail Mary, Scarlett Johansson of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and even Captain Kirk himself, William Shatner, of TV's original Star Trek. Artemis II was a test flight for future moon missions. Despite its rich scientific yield, the nearly 10-day flight was not without technical issues. Both the capsule's drinking water and propellant systems were hit with valve problems. In perhaps the most high-profile predicament, the toilet kept malfunctioning, but the astronauts shrugged it all off. We can't explore deeper unless we are doing a few things that are inconvenient, Koch said, unless we're making a few sacrifices, unless we're taking a few risks, and those things are all worth it. Added Hansen, you do a lot of testing on the ground, but your final test is when you get this hardware to space, and it's a doozy. Under the revamped Artemis program, next year's Artemis 3 will see astronauts practice docking their capsule with a lunar lander or two in orbit around Earth. Artemis 4 will attempt to land a crew of two near the moon's south pole in 2028. The Artemis 2 astronauts' allegiance was to those future crews, Weissman said. But we really hoped in our soul is that we could, for just a moment, have the world pause and remember that this is a beautiful planet and a very special place in our universe, and we shall all cherish what we have been gifted, he said. And in election 2028, I'm thinking about it, Kamala Harris says of 2028 presidential bid. New York. After chance of run again filled the room, former Vice President Kamala Harris told African-American activists on Friday that she's actively considering another presidential bid. I might. I'm thinking about it, Harris told Reverend Al Sharpton after he asked directly whether she was going to run for president in 2028. Harris's comments came during the National Action Network's annual convention, where more than a half dozen potential candidates appeared this week, hoping to make inroads among black voters who comprise one of Democrats' most powerful blocs. Excuse me. The Democrats' next presidential primary season won't begin in earnest until after November's midterm elections. But this week's conference showcased a collection of Democrats already jockeying for position in what promises to be a crowded competition. For now, at least, there is no clear entry early favorite. But there did appear to be a favorite at Sharpton's conference. Harris, the nation's first black female vice president and Democrats' presidential nominee in 2024, earned the only standing ovation and the largest crowd of any other 2028 prospect this week. Sharpton noted that Harris earned more votes in her losing 2024 campaign than even former Democratic presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. Whatever she decides to do, she made a point in history, Sharpton said. Harris has raised the possibility of another presidential bid before the 15 months since she left office. She also recently launched a political action committee and began to travel across the United States to support Democrats, especially across the South. And that's it for today's reading of the Boston Herald. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center, and I thank you for listening.